This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The setting of David Edgar's play, The Shape of the Table, may seem to be ripped from today's headlines. Protesters storm the streets of a nation under authoritarian rule. They want a new government. The ruling elite tries to figure out what to do and contemplates everything from violent repression to abdication. It could be Egypt or Libya, but this play premiered in 1990, a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it deals with an unnamed Eastern European country in transition from communism to democracy. David Edgar is a Tony Award-winning playwright, best known for his adaptation of the Charles Dickens novel Nicholas Nickleby, but he's also well-known for tackling big ideas. And there are few things bigger than the kind of revolution that takes place in The Shape of the Table. Burning Coal Theater Company is presenting the American premiere of The Shape of the Table at the Murphy School in Raleigh from April 7th through the 24th. And here to tell us more, our British playwright David Edgar and Burning Coal's artistic director Jerome Davis. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you for having me here.
Good to be here.
David, this play originally premiered a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Why did you write it?
Well, I wrote it because it seemed when the events were happening in the fall of 1989 that this was really the biggest thing that had occurred since the Second World War, and as I was born in 1948, therefore kind of in my lifetime. And I think we forget now, as we will forget when we look back on the Arab Spring that's happening now, we will think it was inevitable and everybody saw it coming. But actually nobody saw it coming, even despite what was happening in the Soviet Union and the reforms that Mikhail Gorbachev was bringing about. I think nobody thought that the dominoes would fall that quickly or that decisively and that completely. Including in the countries themselves. And I think one of the striking comparisons with today is that what seems an inconceivably ludicrous demand on Monday, on Tuesday is the going rate, and on Wednesday seems extraordinarily modest. And that's what I've tried to capture in the play. And as you say, it if you change the names from names that end with "ov" and "ski," if you change those names to names that involve Muhammad, you suddenly get it does seem like it's the news of this morning.
And it is shocking. I mean, we've had those big changes. I mean, you can go back to the fall of the Raj in India, the end of Jim Crow in the South. These things do change. They seem to change. I mean, obviously, there are things leading up to them. But as you say, the public perception is, it ain't going to change.
Yes,
not in my lifetime.
And also, what happens in terms of – I mean, I'm very interested in the losers. And I think drama, if you look at Shakespeare's great political plays, a lot of them from Richard II to King Lear are more interested in the people giving up power than they are in the people taking it, and I think that's a kind of because they're tragic figures, and you know, we know a lot about Vaclav Havel, the playwright who took over as president of Czechoslovakia, and Lech Walesa in Poland, the shipyard workers' leader. But I think we've forgotten these figures who tried in their often blustering way to catch up with the impetus for reform, and who failed and who ended up watching everything they'd ever believed in crumble around them. So, and I feel very much that this play is like being in Mubarak, you know, president of Egypt, sort of inner circle, as he tried to tried to find a way of hanging on to power. And I think one feels in terms of the reforms, which undoubtedly, you know, people in the South were trying to compromise with the civil rights movement, which again overtook, you know, people were, I think it's the line in the play, you know, were overtaken by their own event, as it were. So I think it is, there are common factors about the giving up of power by very fixed regimes that believe that it's going to go on like this forever.
Jerome, a lucky coincidence for you that these headlines matched, or was this something that you once you knew that this play was right for this time?
Oh no, I saw it coming. No, I didn't at all.
CIA just wouldn't listen.
Right. Yeah. It seems to be prescient, but in fact, the things that interest me about David's writing are not the politics, but the personal aspects of it. The characters in this play and in all of his plays are people who want something and want it fiercely enough to go at it on a national or even international level. And there's something respectable about that, I think, and something intriguing. And so it's always the human element that most interests me about his work.
That's the thing that keeps the big idea from becoming a philosophical essay and what makes it art, David. Is it that? Is it?
Yes, and I think there's a dramatic technique in there. I've always thought that you know, journalism, you know, because I don't want them to be journalism either, and I don't want them to be history lessons, that kind of journalism tells you what's happening and history tells you what happened, and my plays try and tell you what happens. In other words, it's about a syndrome, and one of the convenient things for a playwright about 1989 was that the same thing happened at much greater speed, in at accelerating speed, in five different countries. Romania was a bit different, but all the other five East European countries, basically the same kind of syndrome happened. So I was able, as it were, by inventing a fictional country and a fictional East European revolution, to kind of cannibalize the body parts of the real ones, so to create something which told the whole story, and was in particular able, I think, to create a communist elite, you know, that did understand, you know, that was blinkered and wanted to hang on to power, but also had its own internal conflicts, and in which you can, I hope, feel for people losing power. Mm.
Jerome, tell us about what we're going to see in this play.
Well, it's set in the midst of turmoil in this unnamed country. The people are on the streets. They've been on the streets now for more than a week, and they're agitating for change in the government. The economy is tanking rapidly, and so the play is set within one of the government buildings where they're the government representatives and the Communist Party representatives, who are the real power in those countries, are gathered together and trying to figure out how they can hold on to power, what they can relinquish, and what they dare not, and so it's a chess match, really. And then we are introduced to the people on the outside, some of their leaders, one of whom is not unlike Havel, is a writer. It did seem that artists were at the forefront of these things. Over and over again, we're told theater artists were in the streets in Czechoslovakia, on the square, you know, by the tens of thousands, and which is a strange idea in the United States, a revolution fueled by our college performers and dancers. But it did happen, and it happened within our lifetime.
That certainly happened in Serbia, too. It was street theater that led to the downfall of Indeed. Milosevic. Will you read for us? Can you give us an idea of what we'll hear as well and see?
This is one of the communist leaders near the end of the play. I saw this room first on the 12th of April, 1945. I was with a group of people who, like me, had joined the party when they frankly didn't hand out prizes for it. And that day we occupied this palace. Until that day, the headquarters of the Nazi so-called civilian administration. And as you might imagine, having smashed things up a bit, we fell to raising flags and proclaiming futures of an unimaginable scale and splendor, in which the immense and boundless untapped energies and talents of the masses would be liberated. Every peasant would be Aristotle, every worker Michelangelo. If you'd like, we'd write the last line of the story of mankind, the modest sort of fellows that we were, and where everybody else had got it wrong, we'd finally, unalterably get it right. And this room had obviously been some sort of ballroom, because the walls were covered with great mirrors and gilt frames, and so we stood here and we swore that if we ever looked into a mirror and we couldn't recognize ourselves that day, then we'd tear up our party cards and we'd descend into oblivion. You see, it wasn't that the working class weren't up to it. It was that we weren't up to it.
Jerome Davis, reading from a production of The Shape of the Table. It's going to premiere at the Murphy School in Raleigh from April 7th through the 24th. He is here along with playwright David Edgar, a play, again, set fictionally in after the fall of Berlin, the Berlin Wall. That's something I think we don't consider, that there are actually true believers. We see these movements as sort of ideological monoliths, and once they become corrupt, as certainly the Soviet Union had become, it's hard for us to believe that there are still true believers among those who are in the regime.
Yes, and so that's why it's fascinating. I think if this was a pushover, a moral pushover, then it wouldn't be an interesting play. And obviously, you know, the play is on the side of the revolutionaries. But I think Libya reminds us now that actually there are true believers. It's not just explained by Gaddafi's undoubtedly extremely efficient and dreadful secret police regime and his extremely efficient, you know, state and army. There clearly are supporters. And people who feel that change will be to their detriment. And I think you can see that still in places like Ukraine in Eastern Europe, a sense that for all its incapacity to create prosperity, you know, communism did create a sense of security. And so there's a kind of trade between security and prosperity. And I think we ignore that at our peril. And you know, that is expressed in a beautifully read way. I'm rather sad, although it's going to be brilliantly played, that Jerome is not. It's not. I'm sure he's directed the actor playing that part to do it just as well.
Precisely.
But you know, I was trying to write there the spirit of those young communists who in Eastern Europe, having been under Nazism for 4 or 5 years, who did see an unimaginable future and the failure of that idea. And you know, you hear that and you think of Reagan sitting on a hill. I mean, you think of that kind of rhetoric, which has been part of the foundation of the revolutionary spirit of this country as well.
And it does point to the fact, I mean, there are people in Eastern Europe today who are nostalgic for the good old days of communism. And we just heard a section today, we were talking about people nostalgic for life in the mills, which was not an unalloyed experience for all of them. So I think that's the texture and some of the ambiguities that you bring to a play like this and allow us to see.
Yes, and I think it, you know, it obviously there's a sort of romanticism. There's a thing in Germany called Ostalgia, because Ost is the German for East. So a sort of version of nostalgia, which consists of people coming together and having parties in which they eat old-fashioned East German food and are sentimental about the old, you know, the old decorations and the old interior decoration and how people lived then. And it's partly a kind of postmodern joke, you know, in quote marks. But I think there's also a truth about it, particularly in East Germany, which has not done well economically by unification, certainly relative to West Germany.
Well, and certainly not everybody, and I think that's it. I mean, the same can be said for Russia. I mean, a few people are a lot better off, but by and large, it would be hard to say that everybody is far better off. And so that leads to this question, whether or not we're looking at, you know, there was a certain amount of triumphalism in the West when the East fell. There it is. This is proof that capitalism. But I heard one wag say, no, it's not that communism was that capitalism is the winner, but simply the last to fall. Are we looking at a rolling revolution now? The Arab world, the Muslim world, and ultimately some kind of revolution where it is truly democratic?
Well, it's very interesting because there's a new kid on the block, isn't there? I think we'd all assumed that after the fall of communism, the two contesting forces in the non-democratic countries were authoritarian regimes of one sort or another and fundamentalist Islam, that it was, as it were, it was either Mubarak or Hamas. And now there's a new kid on the block, and that is, you know, a largely secular movement of, I think, a new actor on the world stage, which is the unemployed graduate, which is kids who've come out of university with who know a lot, and you know, I mean, the old thing, what was Egypt? It was Tunisia plus Facebook, who are electronically internet digitally literate. And who are very angry because they've been promised jobs and they've been promised a future which their education has implied, and that future is not there. And I think there are lots of such people in Western countries as well.
Jerome, this I know that your relationship with David goes way back. You have admired his work for a long time. Tell us about that. And
well, I moved from a very rural part of Tennessee in my early 20s to New York City, which was a bit of culture shock. And there's a little place now on 40th Street, the Drama Bookshop, where actors go to read plays and buy plays. And I would go in there, you know, just about every week. And started noticing this name on the shelf, this rather prolific collection of plays with one author, and they were all on subjects that I didn't know much about, and so I started reading them and just found that I was compelled by the writing. David doesn't look down on his audience; he assumes that they're going to be able to follow along and want to follow along, and I respect that. I respect it very much, and it's why we do his plays.
This is the second play you've done here. How do they do it? How is this Southern audience here in Raleigh responding?
This is actually our third. This is part of the trilogy of plays that includes Pentecost and The Prisoner's Dilemma. We've done both of those plays over the last few years, and our audiences have come, and they've enjoyed them, and they've listened to them, and they've talked back to us. And so I feel like it's been a gamble that has paid off in a big way for us.
Glad you're doing it and going to do it again starting April 7th. David Edgar, thank you so much. And Jerome Davis, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having us.
David Edgar, Tony Award-winning playwright, Burning Coal Theater Company is presenting the American premiere of the play The Shape of the Table. It's at the Murphy School in Raleigh. It's from April 7th through the 24th. Jerome Davis is the artistic director of the Burning Coal Theater and the director of The Shape of the Table. By the way, David Edgar is going to be reading at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow night at 6 o'clock or 6:30. Get there early, buy books, and then talk to David. And it's always a good time at Quail Ridge Books. That's tomorrow. For more information about Burning Coal Theater Company and the presentation of The Shape of the Table, go to burningcoal.org. That's our program for today. Our website is stateofthings.org. You can follow us on Facebook as well. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.